It's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, who is, of course, Marilyn Monk. Marilyn does not want me to say much about her, but I will just say a little bit. I'm sure you know Marilyn is really one of the most eminent scientists in the SMN. She is really the leading authority on the whole field of epigenetics. And we will, of course, be hearing more about that tonight. She works with the group of Dame Anne McLaren, I believe, and she's originally from Australia, and she started off working at Melbourne, but then she moved to London fairly early on, and she's been based at University College London for, I think, something like 30 years. 40 years, yeah. However, her interests go way beyond epigenetics. She is passionate about many things. She's passionate, of course, about meditation. She's passionate about horses. Horses is on my list. Passionate about horses. I don't know if they're going to turn up in her talk tonight. She's passionate about the science poet mystic. Sorry, the science post poet mystic connection, which we've heard her talk about on many occasions. She's also a practitioner of Alexander technique and psychosynthesis, and we'll be hearing about that as well in her talk. And I just... So can we turn off mobile phones, please? Thanks. And I should also just say, as I'm sure you know, she's a long-time supporter of the SMN. She's been a member of the SMN for about 30 years. About a year ago, she was on the board of the SMN, and many of you will know her through her excellent and regular column in the Network Review on the latest developments in science and medicine. And we've heard her often make very important contributions from the floor at our meetings, but oddly enough, it's a long time since Marilyn has actually given one of the major presentations at our big weekends. I think the last one, I think, if I recall, was in 2002. So we've had to wait 13 years for this moment, but I'm really glad to introduce Marilyn to give her talk, and I'll just give the reduced title, Conscious Constructive Control of the Self. Epigenetic gene programming in the Alexander technique. Over to you, Marilyn.
Thank you very much. So thank you. So the title of my talk is Conscious Constructive Control of the Self, which sounds extremely grand. It's actually a part of the title of one of Alexander's book on his technique, one of his early books. But it will be about that. Something's going flicker. I'm a molecular biologist, which, of course, is the study of molecules. It's a study of life at a subcellular level, so it's a study of the DNA, the RNA, and proteins. And I've worked in quite a number of different fields over the last over 50 years, originally in DNA replication and repair, and viral infection, viral induction, viral immunity, and then into cell signaling from individual amoebae to make a multicellular structure. And then about 30 years ago, or no, 40 years ago really, I moved to working on gene expression and its regulation in development, that is early embryonic development and shaping up of the fetus. And I like to call this, I'm writing a book called Interplay at the Interface, which is the interplay of genes and environment. And I previously, as Bernard said, I talk about being a scientist, logical, rational, evidence, facts, reproducible by anyone, anywhere, objective truth, the poet's subjective truth, experiential, the imagination, stuff of dreams, intuition, hunches, inner knowing, and the mystic, the bigger picture, the macrocosm, the microcosm, universal laws, and so on. But I've always made a strong case to keep these realms of knowing and being quite separate. They talk to each other within us, but they should never be merged, synthesized, or averaged out in any way. But now I'm going to go against that idea because I'm bringing into this talk Alexander technique, which is the stuff of thoughts and imagination. So The basic question of my talk is, what determines who we are? And are we determined by the genes we inherit? Or we determine about the programming of that gene? By programming, we mean the conditioning of environmental conditioning, which mainly occurs in the womb, conditioning of the fetus, obviously to shape up the different tissues and organs, but also programmed by the state of the mother. The fetus is bathed in the mother's blood and nourished by the mother's blood, so the state of the mother is also programming the baby's genes. And I'm going to talk about ancestral gene programming, our parents, our grandparents, our ancestors. So generally this is the old nature versus nurture environment. Are we determined by the genes we inherit or the conditioning and programming of those genes? But I'm going to say, in my usual way, not either or, but both and more, I'm going to bring in a third possibility. Do we have a say in it at all? And I'm going to call that self-mastery, and I'm going to say that we do. So starting off with nature, the genes. Obviously, the genes, the whole emphasis on genes, started in 1953 with a discovery. Is that a better one? Okay. With the discovery of the structure of DNA by these chaps, who I have known during my career. And then in 1960, also in Cambridge, Sidney Brenner and colleagues worked out the genetic code. And I'm going to describe to you the science of the genetic code and the science of epigenetic programming, because you'll probably all have heard of epigenetics quite a lot recently. It's a very important, burgeoning subject at the moment, but we're talking about the genes at the moment. And the discovery of DNA and the elucidation of the genetic code, scientists have thought for about, 40 years that everything was solved, that DNA was the master molecule. This led to the idea of the central dogma. DNA is the master molecule. It makes the messenger RNA, which goes off and makes all the proteins that govern life, and that's the end of it. So it was thought that since DNA is the master molecule, that if we could sequence the whole human genome, we'd know everything. We'd know all about diseases, we'd all know all about health and well-being and flourishing. We would just know everything if we sequenced the whole human DNA. That didn't happen. It was a bit obvious to me that it wouldn't happen. So this is just to remind you of the structure of DNA. Here's a cell. In the nucleus, you have chromosomes. Chromosomes consist of this double helix, and this is a sugar phosphate backbone. And this, projected inwards from the sugar molecules, are what's called bases. These are sort of six carbon rings, mostly. And there are four bases, and it happens that guanine always pairs with cytosine, with hydrogen bonds, and thymine always pairs with adenine, thymine, adenine, cytosine, guanine, and so on. And that base pairing ensures that like begets like. So when the DNA unravels and you make two more copies of DNA, that specific base pairing will make two exact replica copies of DNA. And the other thing to understand, that the sequence of bases along a strand, T, C, A, A, well, I don't want to, A, A, G, C, and so on, the sequence of that bases code for the genes. And the sequence is read off in triplets, and each triplet codes for a different amino acids. And so when the messenger RNA takes a copy of the DNA out of the cytoplasm, we get a protein made according to the lineup of those different amino acids. So that's how it all works. And that was thought to be all that we needed to know. So the central dogma, the genes we inherit, or what I've called nature, just that we've got 46 chromosomes, we've got 20,000 genes in duplicate, 20,000 from mum, 20,000 from dad. All cells have the same genes. There are household genes, and these are concerned with metabolism, growth and repair, cell division and so on. All cells need them, they're housekeeping genes. And then there are tissue-specific genes, obviously active in different tissues. So specific cohorts of genes are active according to the requirements for specific function. So we have nerve genes active in nerve, muscle genes active in muscle, gut genes active in gut, and so on. There's about 100 different cell types. And of course, in muscle, you turn off nerve and gut and so on. So this was known since the 1950s, and there was thought obviously there had to be some mechanism for choosing cohorts of genes to be active and inactive. And the mechanism was called epigenetics by Waddington in the 50s, but nobody had any idea what it was. So there's also different genes specifying your mood, your behaviour, your life view, susceptibility to lifestyle disease, stress, whatever. So now, here, this is the gene, so that's the nature bit. So the next thing, question to ask, well, how is the gene activity, how do we select the genes that are regulated up and down and on and off? So now we get to epigenetics, and this is a slide I made in the 80s, trying to think, what would be the mechanisms to turn genes on and off? And very naively, so a sort of DNA conformation, you could just put the DNA in a terrible tangle. You couldn't possibly read that out, and that wouldn't function. Or you could wrap it, we knew the DNA was wrapped around these balls of proteins called nucleosomes. You could change those balls of proteins in such a way that you could turn a gene off. Methylation is something I knew about because it was a known mechanism in bacteria, and the differential methylation of different bases in the DNA was the way the bacteria handled their immunity. So if a virus came in that was methylated in the wrong way, the bacteria would say, oh, that's not one of us, that's not a thing that should be here, and they'd chop it up. So I knew about methylation modification. We could also suggest that use it or lose it, use effects function. If you're already open and being transcribed, you might stay that way, and if you weren't, you might not. And there's nuclear compartments. So I decided to work on whether methylation could be controlling gene activity. And to keep, so the methylation of, we're talking about the methylations of the C's, that those C's, could that control gene activity? And just to dazzle you with more science, so this is the linear arrangement of the bases, but of course that's in a double helix. These bars represent the bases pairing with each other. And if you, this is a cytosine molecule, a six-carbon ring, and if you methylate the five-carbon position, covalent methylation, a modification of that, so we've methylated those cytosines, in a part of the gene that regulates, that has regulatory activity, then that gene alters its conformation and turns off. Okay, and we showed that to be the case, but I won't go into specific experiments. And then, so that was way back in the 80s, but subsequently it's turned out that all of these modifications superimposed upon the genes, the high-order chromosome structure, the methylation, the modification of the protein so it's wound around, and regulating molecules and location in the cell. So all those are involved in modifying stretches of DNA in such a way that you cause a specific gene to be regulated up and down, on and off. I hope you're all following me, okay? Yeah? So we could think in computer technology, terminology, that the genes are sort of the hardware and the programming of the genes is software. But now we have the next question. What regulates the epigenetics? So obviously now we get to environment, or what used to be called nurture. So environment, I've decided to call that external dogma in order to combat the central dogma, dominance. So environmental signals, for instance, sensory signals received by the brain, which releases circulating informational molecules, go specific cell receptors that release transcription factors inside the cells that go to the nucleus and alter gene function on and off. So also the cellular environment, just the milieu, the medium surrounding your cells act directly on the metabolism. So the external environment that the cells are bathed in, signals and nutrient composition, toxins, etc. The environment is signaling the genes to go on and off, up and down. So when does that happen? When, because we're talking about what makes us who we are. Is it our genes or our programming of our genes? Is it nature or nurture? So when does all these genes turn on and off? Well, you have obviously tissue-specific gene activation in the fetus in the womb that's orchestrating the shaping up the fetus, saying you be liver, you be lung, you be skin, you be this. And the mother, as I said before, the mother's environment very strongly programs gene expression in the fetus. If the mother is stressed during a lot of the pregnancy, we know the genes that are turned off in the fetus. For instance, glucocorticoid receptor gene in the hippocampus is turned off, and that's a gene that would normally be mopping up cortisol. And if that's turned off in the fetus, it's inherited. Those epigenetic modifications inherited with each cell division throughout life. So we have a stressed baby and a stressed adult. And then when the baby's born into its newfound environment in the early years, obviously it needs to adapt to external environment, physical, nutritional, emotional, psychological. And if there's a good environment, there's caring, love, support. Love is, strangely enough, they've looked at so many factors in the environment affecting well-being and flourishing in children. Turns out that love of the major carers is the one that seems to be the most effective. But we could have guessed that as well. But also there can be abuse, abandonment, neglect. Terrible things can happen to kids in early life. And it's none of their choosing. They just, it's a lottery of chance. It's already a lottery of chance what genes you get. And it's a lottery of chance what your mum's state in when she's pregnant. And it's a bit of a lottery of chance what your early environment's like. So we've got really no say in who we turn out to be, it seems, so far. And there's so these changes inherited throughout life and affect the whole life view, future health and flourishing of the fetus. So what's the evidence for that? Okay, the evidence for that is examining large cohorts of individuals. For instance, there are 17,500 babies born in 1958, and they've been monitored, you know, maybe every couple of years, at tested intervals for the economic status of the family, the quality of the childhood, you know, whether they're healthy babies, their mental health and the mental health of the parents, whether they have psychological troubles and stress, what's the local environment, is it full of gangs or is it safe and harmonious, what's the education like. So all these things can be very accurately monitored in quality of life measures and so on, and it's been shown absolutely conclusively from such studies that early development definitely determines your life view for life. It determines your imagined potential, the flourishing, your well-being, determines later health throughout life. In determining later health, lifestyle diseases such as heart disease, stroke, cancer, mental illness, obesity, diabetes, depression, anxiety, pain, behaviour, all can be linked without any doubt. Most of these studies are done in the States, actually. They can be linked to the quality of early childhood. And then we can use animal models. And you can show with rats that you can induce bad mothering by removing the pups and doing awful things to the mother. And I don't do this, but the experiments have to be done to understand these things. And with bad mothering, in other words, the babies, the mother's not licking and grooming them and looking after them. And with bad mothering, they've actually shown absolute silencing of over 200 genes in hippocampus. The hippocampus is smaller, there's less protein synthesis, and I've already told you about this. And some of these genes are definitely identified with ill-being or well-being. So this is comparing the rat pups. And they inherit the stressful state throughout life. And this is measured by putting in an open field behavior. So they go in a cage with a grid so their movement can be monitored by a computer. And if they sort of creep around the edges and cringe, they're stressed rats. And if they go exploring and have a good time, they're not. And then you could say, well, this is animal models, you know. It's not as bad as cell culture, but it's an animal model. What about human beings? And the only evidence is not a very large sample, but in Canada, suicide victims were divided into those people who'd had a bad start in life and those that had a good start in life but had committed suicide with some current trauma or stress. And it showed that the suicide victims who had a bad start in their life had a very deficient small hippocampus and a lot of the genes turned off in common with these genes with the rat. So that's very strong evidence that quality of childhood conditions you for life. So again, have we got any say in what happens to us? And even to make things even worse, there's ancestral programming. So there's the actual gene programming in parents having adapted to their environment or grandparents adapting to their environment, that can be inherited transgenerationally into offspring. Now, this was called Lamarckian inheritance, and it was Lamarckian inheritance is adaptive inheritance. You inherit the experiences of parents and grandparents as distinct from Darwinian inheritance, which is random mutations, selection over millions of years. Lamarckian inheritance goes parents, grandparents to offspring. And this was a great taboo amongst the neo-Darwinians because they couldn't think of molecular mechanism. But actually, we did one of the first experiments to show that there was differential methylation silencing of a specific functional gene passing through egg. So for adaptive inheritance, the actually altered gene expression has to come through egg and sperm. And you must distinguish it from what's called cultural inheritance. Cultural inheritance is this is the way your parents prepare a meal, so you've learned to prepare a meal so that you copy the way your parents do things. So adaptive inheritance is actually changes in levels of gene expression by epigenetic modifications passing through sperm and egg. And well, we did that in the mid-90s, but in the last few years, papers are coming out like all the time about transgenerational or ancestral inheritance, fear, stress, trauma, smoking, starvation. Interestingly, interesting things happen. Like if parents have been starved, like in the Dutch hunger, time of Dutch hunger during the war, their children are born obese and are likely to have diabetes because with the starvation, the parent's metabolome has adapted and shifted across, like I was saying yesterday, to make maximum use of all foodstuff to provide energy. So when the children are born and there's plenty of food around, they get very fat. Things like that happen. So is who we are a lottery of chance? And I must say, at the moment, we have to all consider that I'm just one of hundreds of possible me's, as I said yesterday, that if I had been born, like, as he said, Paul Gilbert said, if I'd been born into a Mexican drug cartel, I would have been a different Marilyn. Or you can imagine all sorts of circumstances that you could have been born in, and it would have been a different you. But having been conditioned into a role that we play in our society, I think it's, you know, I always sort of compare us with bees because bees all have the same genes, but they're programmed differently. So you have nurse bees look after the eggs, you have farmer bees that look after where you put the honeycomb, you have forager bees and you have warrior bees. They've all got the same genes, but their different behaviour is programmed and superimposed on those genes. And recently it's been shown that the same bee can deprogram and reprogram into different roles. So all in service to the higher order structure. And of course the higher order structure is in service to the bees because it's telling them all what to do and in what numbers and everything to make sure the beehive is the best beehive it can be. So we can assume we're in service to a higher order structure and we're all playing different roles that we're supposed to play. But it's unclear to me what our higher order structure is. So we don't choose our genes or our early conditioning. We just inherit the genes we inherit. We don't choose the development who we are, keeping in mind we could have been several different versions of ourselves. And even parental ancestral environment is programming and handed down to, do we have a say in it at all? So now I come to the inner environment. You know, it's very unscientific of me. I'm coming to our imagination of our thoughts, and I've given that a name of an inner dogma. And I'm going to make this the most important dogma there is. Imagination is a mental faculty of forming images of external objects not present to the senses, and belief is an acceptance of those imagined objects as truth. And it's indisputable that imagination and belief bring about profound changes in our biology, our health, and our well-being. Imagination fires our neurology, our physiology, same as the real thing. Oh. So our bodies are constantly responding to our changing environment of our thoughts, our emotions, our imaginings, our expectations, every thought you have goes into your body. Think of something worrying. Every tendon, muscle, everything changes. Think, oh, I'm looking forward to that. Everything changes again. Every thought, emotion. Oh, that's depressing. Everything. So you are, every thought you have go into your body. You are what you think. Your biology is in one of two states, cells and tissues. It's either just growing happily, being nourished and repairing is all beneficial, or it's in a protection state. It's repelled by something frightening or toxic, and this is stressful. And so our body, the chemicals going around our body and our cells and tissues responding to those chemicals is either in a beneficial or stressful state at any one time. The response to imagined situations, same as the real situation, same neurological and physiological, and it's huge. I mean, if you imagine, I mean, Pavlov did this over 100 years ago, but if you imagine that you're in a dark alley and you're about to be mobbed, within seconds, your pupils dilate, your hair stands on end, your skin temperature changes, your heart rate changes, your breathing changes, your blood leaves your digestive system, go to your muscles. Huge changes in your body. And it's just a thought, okay? We could, if I had time, I could do some experiential stuff in pairs and showing how the amazing way your thought goes straight into your body in hugely powerful ways. And probably that was a selectable in evolution. I mean, imagining that something could harm you is probably better than going to check it out, okay? So if you were a nice little zebra and you saw some rustling in some grasses over there, you could imagine a lion, it's best to run. You know, if you went to check it out, you wouldn't have any offspring, so it wouldn't be a good thing for your evolving. And your response is... Oh, your response is influenced by your remembered conditioning. Remember, I've told you that the conditioning of your genes for stress or whatever. I mean, we are in fight, flight, or freeze. If you can't pay the mortgage or you're not going to get home in time or you're worried that that builder was no good, you're in fight, flight, freeze. And whereas normally fight, flight, and freeze is over once you've been eaten or you've got away or you've hidden successfully. In the case where we're triggering fight, flight, freeze mechanisms of stress in our body over the worries of every day, we're in a constant state of stress, which is incredibly damaging. So, well, could we just turn that all around? And could we put our thoughts and imagining, could we put that in charge of our response to environmental stimuli? Yes, we could. So our inner imagined environment programs our life view, our health and well-being by programming our genes up or down, on or off. Now, what's the evidence for that? We can look at sociological, psychological, whether we're looking very difficult at the whole person, neurological, physiological, we look at organs and cells, and we can look at molecular evidence of actual genes being turned on and off by placebo, by our imagination, or associated with turning points in development. Not yet. So sociological and psychological evidence, we all know that. Complementary medicine, positive thinking, affirmations, imaging, attitudes, life view, you are what you think. What is the evidence? Large cohorts of individuals, largely in the States, have been studied for their health, well-being, their quality of life measures, and they've shown that the health and well-being is influenced by these positive emotions, social network, education, safe environments, marriage, church attendance, faith, medicine, etc. And when I'm talking about health, it's lifestyle diseases. Lifestyle diseases are what is using up the NHS. They're non-communicable. They're diseases we cause by the way, by our life view and the way we live our life. And the NHS is totally swamped with heart disease and stroke and obesity and stress and mental illness and cancer. These are non-communicable lifestyle diseases. Then we've also got placebo, nocebo. Placebo is so huge. It's totally amazing that the thought that this drug, which is really a sugar pill, will work, is so powerful. I could give you lots of evidence for that, some experiments being done in Oxford. It's just amazingly powerful. You can plot placebo on graphs with tiny standard errors. You can take 100 people and you'd say, well, 25 of you are going to get the real thing. Take another 100, say 50 of you will get the real thing. Take another 100, say 75. And depending on that cohort's expectation of getting the real drug, you can plot the effect accurately. And then here we're going to go on to Alexander technique. I'm hoping I'm going to have some time to do something experiential. Constructive control of the self. We still, when we have the molecular evidence, you see, the trouble with the studies on whole beings is that you can never really be sure of the causation because you've got something called reverse causality. Are you happier because you're married, or you're married because you're a happier person? Are you more healthy because you meditate, or do meditators eat more muesli? That's the first one. The first one is reverse causality. Church attendance, by the way, is correlated with faith, not community. And faith is something that we all have. It's an inherent human quality. I just say if existence has looked after me for how many billions of years, it's looked after my ancestors, it's likely to look after me tomorrow. So I have faith that I'm cared for. So you've got confounding influences and reverse causality. We can get some molecular evidence for placebo and nocebo. I'm trying. I've got, you know, we've only got whole person evidence for the effectiveness of Alexander technique. If we can convert this to actually changing the program of our genes for a better well-being, health, we could call it consciousness medicine. We'd have evidence and we could really move in that direction to program ourselves. So, oh, and then, of course, wonderful old Pavlov. He knew ages ago. We talked about him yesterday, about ringing the bell and the salivation, the gastric juices and so on. But Pavlov did a lot more about that. He had those four temperament types, sort of preceding Jung's types. And he talked about transmarginal inhibition, which is really the turning off of loads of genes, which is a desensitization of kids if they've been abandoned, abused, neglected. They just have lost their compassion with the turning off of all those genes. I'm not going to talk about neurological with all these neurological people here. But anyway, what we can say is the wiring of the brain is not static or fixed. Well-being is a skill to be learnt. Oh, did I go? So this is the real question. Could we program our genes? Could we reprogram ourselves? Could we deprogram our future? Could we direct evolution for maximum well-being for future generations? I mean, this could sound really pie in the sky, but I really believe we could. The point is, there's not much sign of it. There's not much evidence of it. There's loads of evidence, as there always is, for deleterious stuff, things that make people sick. There's loads of evidence at the molecular level for what goes wrong. But we don't collect evidence. Scientists and medics, they're not collecting evidence for things that are going right. Turning points. A turning point is when you have a batch of kids that they're really little muggers. They've been little monsters. And then they're expelled from school and then in a corrective institution. And then they have a horrible adolescence and end up in jail. But there are rare turning points. It's sad that they're rare, but they're very definite. And they're usually 24/7 removal of that child from the family of origin and from the environment that's reminding the child all the time of who it is, his peer group and everything. You're always reminding, you're the, you know, real tough little bully, you know. So complete removal. Surprisingly, the army is wonderful. Number of turning points happen in the army when these boys get there to put in a uniform. They've got a sort of sense of purpose and presence, and they're marching in step, and they've got common purpose, and they can complete turning points in the army. And also, if a boy meets a girl in a pub and gravitates to her parents in peer group, can be a turning point. Or in a case like me, I'm sure I was pretty wild in the bush in Australia. I was removed from there and very young and put in a residential college and then even left Australia on a scholarship, only 21, and incredibly naive. And here alone. Here we go again. No, we don't. So turning points happen, but they're rare. Why are they rare? What are the barriers to change? We've heard a bit from Alison about habit. We are stimulus response machines. Call this a stimulus, that's the response. Locked together. If you've done it that way the first time, then you've done it that way the next time, then you've done it that way the next 100 times, you're going to do it that way forever. So that is going to be a huge barrier. Then there's faulty sensory perception. With Alexander technique, it can only be taught by a hands-on method, which helps people to undo the stuff that they're doing that's in the way of their birthright, which is poise, balance, and presence. And so it can only be taught hands-on because of faulty sensory perception. What feels familiar feels right. So if you always got into a chair like this, and you always got out of a chair like that, that if you actually were to use yourself correctly, it would feel a bit peculiar at first, okay? So faulty sensory perception is also in the way of change. And also people who think they know you. And so what if you change and you start behaving differently? They'll say, who do you think you are, you know? Or there are people who say, I can't understand why she did that. I'd never do that. You know, completely unable to allow that person has completely different approaches to life, values and so on. Doesn't make them wrong, okay? So we tend to inhibit each other from change. Stimulus response. Don't you ever think there's some of my needy? Now, the Alexander technique is the only technique that I've actually experienced, although I really appreciate what Alison was saying about mindfulness, that I think Alexander technique really provides the tools for change if you really want to practice it and use it. And you can anchor the use of the technique to some certain functions and just decide you anchor the technique to cleaning your teeth or going downstairs or waiting for the train. You just anchor it to more and more, or writing with a pen. And it starts to take over. So the Alexander technique is self-mastery. And self-mastery, stimulus is happening all the time, especially your thoughts. So, oh God, that's a worry. But I could have inhibit. The thought could be, that's a worry, but I don't do that. So I could have the thought, that's a worry, I inhibit the normal response that pulls me down. That's a hiatus. Or pause. You put a hiatus before. You just say no. That's what I call free won't or intentional inhibition. I'm going to sit in the chair. That's a thought. No. I'm going to think neck free, head forward and up, back lengthen one, continue those directions, make those directions for maximum poise and balance the higher priority than getting to the chair. So inhibit. Direct. Now, direct is release unnecessary tension, all unnecessary tension. Your body is going to be, all the tendons and muscles and everything about your body is going to be in a pattern that was actually associated with your response to the last stimulus. So if that person, not you, that person over there has made me really mad, you know, and I've got this whole pattern in my body, and then I turn over here and I see somebody I like and say, what do you want? You know, so I've carried over the whole pattern of my response to the previous stimulus to the next stimulus. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you must release all unnecessary tension. And of course, unnecessary tension allows the postural reflex. The postural reflex is a reflex. It goes through the spine. It's not something you do. Your feet, metatarsals spreading on the floor, your weight going through to the floor sets up a reflex through the spinal cord that sends you up in response to gravity, unless you're in the way of that response of lengthening. You'll be in the way if you've got the heavy weight of the skull pull back and down on the top of the spine. So, okay, we're going to give ourselves directions for maximum poise and balance, and maximum poise and balance equals presence. And we're going to continue that direction and choose the response. Now, whatever the stimulus is, I can choose to respond with the old pattern of behavior if I want to. I can choose to respond with the old habits, or I can choose to respond from a place of quiet and stillness without compromising poise, balance, and presence. I could do something irrelevant, or I could do nothing, but the choice of the response is the self-mastery. But you've got, in order to do this, you've got to say, you've got to unhook stimulus and response. You've got to say, this is stimulus, you say no to responding, okay? Then direct, then continue direction. And the rules of Alexander Technique, if you eliminate the wrong, the right comes through of its own accord. And we heard David talk about his golf stroke, where he eliminated the thought, try. If you think the word try, you'll tense your body. If you tense anywhere in your body, you'll pull your head back down on your spine. The word try causes tension in the body. The poise and balance and functioning is a birthright. We have gone wrong by getting in the way of what's natural. And I'll express that. Eliminate the wrong and the right gets through of its own accord. When you eliminate the wrong, it's not to try to do something right. You just eliminate the wrong. The use of yourself is the highest priority. Your means whereby you perform a function or you respond to stimulus, the means whereby you use yourself in that process is more important than gaining the end. You think you throw the ball to your kids. You throw the ball, kid can't catch it. Yeah, startle response. So he's got that response every time a ball comes near him, you know. You've got to throw the ball, and the child's got to think, it's not important if I don't catch it, okay? And as I say, to be Mary Steenburgen, she says that Alexander Technique is to be the best me I can be. It doesn't mean you're going to be a perfect specimen of perfect posture. It means you're going to... I mean, I myself have got huge problems with my spinal cord and my spine and my vertebrae and pain. And I can say what the Alexander Technique has done for me to be the best me I could be. I think without it, I'd be paralyzed or dead. I really do. And there are lots of stories of people who have trained in Alexander Technique because they have real limitations in their physical cells. And there's amazing, with amazing results. Okay, now, worried about the time. So let me say a bit about Alexander. He was Australian, like myself, born in Tasmania. And he liked to recite Shakespeare poetry on stage. He loved to act. But by the time he was 19, every time he got on stage, he lost his voice, completely lost his voice. And he'd gone to Melbourne by the time he was 20, and he went to lots of voice specialists and doctors. What am I going to do? Every time I get on stage, I lose my voice. And they'd all say to him, well, rest your voice. And, of course, when he rested his voice, it came back. Then he'd get on stage again and lose his voice again. So he made a very, very clever observation. It must be something I am doing when I act on stage that's causing the loss of voice. Can you imagine if you went to a GP for a quick fix and your GP said to you, what is it you're doing to cause this problem? You know, we expect men. So he decided that he did this really intensive research on himself with mirrors all around, and he watched himself when he started to recite, and he noticed he took up a position, you know, as you might if you're going to do something dramatic with Shakespeare or something. And he noticed when he did that, took up a position to recite, his head went back and down in his spine, his stature shortened, and his back narrowed and shortened. And he saw, well, maybe that's got something to do with it. And of course it does. If you go like that, you sort of jam your voice box, you know. And so he observed that it was something he was doing, head back and down, back narrow and shortened in stature. So he decided, he tried, so he said, I won't do that. So he developed this concept of inhibit, So I'll give myself the stimulus to recite, but I'm not going to do that. And then he tried lots of versions of doing something different. Stick your head forward. That didn't work either. And then he got it. The way to deal with the problem was with his thought. So he'd inhibit the response, and he'd give the thought not the head back, and to allow the head forward and up, to allow the back to lengthen and widen. So it's a thought direction. And with that, he regained the use of his voice and continued his acting, but his technique that he taught with the use of gentle guidance with the hands has gone all around the world. So the directions are: let the neck be free, to allow the head to go forward and up in relation to the top of the spine, in such a way the back lengthens and the back widens. Okay. So notice, let the neck be free, not free the neck. To allow the head to go forward and up, not to stick your head forward and up. In other words, it's a non-doing, not a doing. It's an undoing of what's in the way. So if I said to you, well, that's just showing a picture of a startle pattern, very common, and here she's freed the neck to allow the head to go forward and up in relation to the spine. I just made a mistake then. I said she freed the neck, but she didn't. She didn't do anything. She undid the tension to allow the neck to be free. Okay, if I asked you, and Alexander, I'm not teaching you, Alexander. I could give you some experiential things to try if I had time, but I don't think I do. But it has to be done with gentle guidance from the hands because of that faulty sensory perception. So if I said, let the neck be free, would you be thinking of changing some muscles in the face or doing something with your neck? Releasing all unnecessary tension. There's always some necessary tension. Of course, you've got suboccipital muscles there that just with the right tension hold the head like that. If they weren't working and you went to sleep, your head would drop, you know. So it's releasing all unnecessary tension. So obviously, you wouldn't know where to begin if you had to do it. You have to undo what's in the way, relax all the facial muscles. What I want to say is, if you actually have any tension anywhere in your body, then your neck, jaw will tense in sympathy. So if you actually thought of making a really tight fist, you'll frown or do something with your jaw. So all tension anywhere in the body, will pull your head back and down on the spine. Now, I want you to think about where is the top of your spine, because a heavy weight of the skull on top of the spine. So maybe you could look at each other and point where you think your top of the spine is. Top of the spine. All right. So as I said, any tension anywhere in the body will tighten these muscles. The top of your spine is sort of between your ears, and at this point you have the really heavy weight of the skull and the jaw balanced here. Now this joint has the tiniest of movements. If you put your attention between your ears and imagine the tip of your nose is connected to your belly button by a gossamer thread, and just move the tip of your nose up and down a millimeter, because you don't want to break that gossamer thread, and you have a sense of where that joint is. Okay? Anybody got that? Now, if you were to stand up, anybody who wants to, and think of, somebody must want to stand up. And if you think of letting all your weight go down through your feet to the center of the planet, just let, at the same time that you think all the weight going down, think of a power of electrons coming up in the other direction, sending you up. And think of your head sort of going a little bit back and up in response, moving not back and down, back and up. So dropping the tip of the nose and thinking of all your weight going down and allowing your head to float off the top of the spine, which you know where it is now. Just let your head float off the top of the spine and releasing all the necessary tension. Some of you might feel the lengthening in response to gravity, which is your birthright. Is anybody feeling it a little bit? So allowing all the weight to go down, your head to float off the top, letting all the muscles in your face relax, letting your shoulders drop down your back, your tailbones dropping down towards the floor, and your head's floating off the top, and your back can lengthen, your back can widen. Now, if I was able to come around you all and put hands on, we can take chest when the neck is free, because you can put the slightest touch, which, you know, if we had more time, we could do some experiential stuff, and the head would just float off. Okay, that's fine. Now, it's very important. You see this curvature of the spine, okay? That curvature is really important because it gives mechanical strength. So if I put two curves in that, you see it's strong? Yeah? If I let my back slump, if I too straight, boom. So those curves in the spine give the spine mechanical strength, okay? So they have to be there. So you're going to look after your head-neck-spine relationship, not the heavy weight of the skull back and down on this joint. If this joint is fixed with a brace or something, you'd fall over. So this is what, these are suboccipital muscles, and this is what normally we're doing and completely inactivates the postural reflex, and this is what should be happening. And that can only happen by non-doing what's in the way. Now, it is your birthright to have perfect postural reflex. So, little children, you get that nothing happening, ready for anything when there's no unnecessary tension. Nothing happening, ready for anything. This is my son. This is a little angle poise lamp. The head is going up, forward and up, on top of the spine, hips are going back, knees are going forward, ankles going back. It's that perfect posture that's our birthright that we're born with. And then what happens? So these are terribly old slides. They were actually 35 millimeter slides that I've tried to make. So look what's happened, okay? This is your birthright and this is still there. So why? What happened to us? Well, the worst thing that happened to us, we were taught to try to get it right somehow or other. And the first time that you have to do something like pick up a pen and join up letters, catch a ball, or anything you have to do as a kid, you're trying to get it right somehow or other. And the somehow or other is the habitual response that you always have to that stimulus. So you're always being told to get it right, catch the ball, join up your letters, whatever. And there's attention, that's end-gaining. Getting it right is end-gaining. There's no attention to the means whereby we use this. We're also protecting. When we stood up, when we were on four legs and we had a backbone, and the vulnerable throat and underbelly were protected by the armour of the backbone. So when you stand up, you open the neck and the belly. And we want a lot of people, if they feel vulnerable, they want to... They want to cover that up. And imagine you're fixing your diaphragm, you're squashing all your internal muscles, your diaphragm's not gently going up and down the gut, which is one of the major sensations of well-being, is the diaphragm with your breathing, massaging your gut. But if you pull down, the head goes back, it's all internal organs are being crushed. So often we pull down because we feel vulnerable. There's looking cool. There's copying parents and peer group. It's non-threatening to sort of slouch about, you know. When you stand up and open in front, it's vulnerable, but it's also quite confronting. You're not so vulnerable because your back is strong and you can feel that. The barriers to change is the stimulus response. Habitual responses are ingrained. They're grooved in your brain. What's familiar feels right. Now, I'm just going to show you some examples and then I'll finish. So here's a little boy. He's that look, nothing happening, ready for anything. Total presence, awareness. What happens, you know? These guys, sort of about 10 years old, I think what they're doing is looking cool. Here, get it right. Get your writing. Look, the jaw's tense. Look how he's gripping the pen. And look at the frown and things. Whenever these kids write for their whole life, the response to picking up a pen will be this. It's even, you're forced, stand up straight. This is a bat. He's being told to stand up like this. And, I mean, that's just appalling. So Alexander would say, with faulty use of self is associated with faulty thinking. Would we really trust the views of this politician? So faulty thinking associated with distorted use of self and vice versa. As I said, we're not all going to be perfect specimens. I myself have got hideous problems with my spine and spinal cord, but I feel so grateful that I have the technique to be, despite that, to be able to. So in most activity we do, there's too much effort and strain. I've said this. But we do pay. Think of the tools that we use in life. You know, your saw, your toothbrush, your hairbrush, your golf club, your tennis club. We pay attention to how we use those tools because we know that use affects function, okay? If you use your tools efficiently, they'll function well. This is also true of us because we're on the other end of these tools. If we use ourselves with maximum poise and balance as we're supposed to, we will function more efficiently and with pleasure. If there are activities you do in response to stimuli that you really don't like doing, you can be sure your use is pretty distorted. Make means whereby more important than gaining in. So self-mastery is being in charge of the activity rather than the activity being in charge of you. So I'll give you some picture examples from that, if I may, and then stop, because you need to see visually what that means. So speeding up. So here's a place, this little boy, he's not distorted. He's picked up a chair, he's carrying it, but he's still got his perfect use. Perfect use. Here's somebody sitting in a chair beautifully. Here's somebody who's decided to sit here and then slump. See how she's compressing her internal organs. If I had time, I could teach you how to sit in a chair experientially. Again, right miss. Head back and down, compressing, pulled down in front. That's an effort to sit like that. That's also wrong. So for sitting, you need to stand on your sit bones. If you were to put your hands under your sit bones, you need to feel maximum weight going down the sit bones. If you were to slump, you'd feel your sit bones moving forward. So you're going to have to support your weight with muscle. If you sit up straight, the lift off the back. Again, muscular strain. Stand on them. Here's getting out of the chair, right slump. Here's getting out, right tension. When you go down in space like this, we don't, if you avoid using the word down, because this is a lengthening, because in Alexander technique, this process is actually opening the hip joints and opening the knee joints. If you were to put yourself against the wall and send your knees forward without losing any height, obviously what's happening is my knees are opening and my hips are opening. Most people bend their knees and give themselves arthritis by sinking and sitting on them. To pick up a weight like that is sheer madness. You maintain's a bad word, that's sort of fixed. You give all your attention to correct head neck back relation and use the power of the legs. This is actually tilting two vertebrae and pushing a disc into the spinal cord, back pain. The waist is not a hinge. We hinge at head hips, knees, and ankles. The waist is not a hinge. Nearly finished, Bernard. Again, perfect use, dreadful use. Dreadful, good. Here, the books, where am I? Here the book's pulling him down. The book's in charge of this activity. Here, he's in charge of that activity. Tennis racket in charge. She's in charge. Self-mastery. He's in charge. I watched Mo Farah win today. And you could see when he crossed the winning line, he looked like this. And all the ones that were losing, the thought losing went into their bodies. And they all, oh, in a mess. Here the violin's in charge. Here she's in charge. So self-mastery means that you don't distort your use for any activity, putting your hand in a arm in a coat sleeve or getting in and out of a car, cleaning your teeth, brushing your hair, carrying a case, distorting her. Here she's making means whereby more important. So to go with grace through life, I would recommend the Alexander technique. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Marin, so much. I mentioned Marin has many passions in the introduction, and many of those, of course, came across in the talk. It was a real privilege to hear about epigenetics from the person who's made such an important contribution to the field. But then, of course, we heard the, well, to me, even more amazing concept that we can actually reprogram our own genes, and then that we can, in some sense, do that by choosing our response. And although you didn't say so explicitly, it seemed to me that was a rather beautiful answer to the question of posed by our meeting, free spirits or determined machines. I assume free spirits is the implication.
Definitely.
From that. And then, of course, we went into that wonderful sort of second part of the talk about the Alexander technique, where you change gear. And I know we could have had much more time to do experiments. And
another meeting.
Even now, I'm worried about standing here in case I'm not standing in the right way. Now,
get it right.
We have got 10 minutes. In theory, we end at 8:15, but I do have David's permission to go on until 8:30. So we have 10 minutes. David, really, you extended the deadline to 8 to 9:30. So, I mean, is that firm? How firm are you? He's completely firm, and maintain that posture. Yep. Now, I think it's best to have a discussion. I don't think at this session there's any time for the experiential aspect because we have 10 minutes. I think we should have the ten minutes for discussion. And the question is whether we should spend 5 minutes of that having the round table discussion.
I don't want to lose the time to ask her a question. I think it's more important.
Yeah, yeah. So are we happy to forego the round table discussions and go straight into questions?
Yes.
I think in the circumstances, although by and large, I think the round table discussion has worked out very well. But in view of time shortage, let's go straight into questions. Can we have the microphone people, please? And make your questions even shorter than usual and the answers even shorter than usual because we've only got 10 minutes. Right, over to Roger. Can we have the microphone over there?
Marilyn, I thought that was a brilliant exposition. My question concerns the epigenetics part, and I wondered whether you were considering only those genes that code for amino acids, or whether you're considering the whole of the DNA, because as we know, an enormous lot of DNA is so-called junk, doesn't code for amino acids.
Yeah. What do you mean, the genes that are coding for the protein?
Yes,
yeah.
The coding
so
genes.
As I said yesterday, these days there are high-throughput techniques where you can look at everything all at once. And what you would do if you had two cohorts where you had say with that large cohort, you picked out the turning points because you got blood samples over 55 years. You could take those blood samples and do a methylome analysis initially and see how the methylome had changed in the turning point people whose lives had turned around to a very healthy life.
So you're dealing with the whole...
The whole DNA. You're looking at the whole pattern of programming.
Yes.
You can do that. So that if you could get the relevant people who you could say had turned their lives around, you could measure, and you had their blood spots over intervals over 50 years, you could work out, you could see what had changed.
Yeah. I won't take a long time, but perhaps you know the work of the Russian Peter Garaev, who on what he calls the wave genome, which is how the junk DNA functions.
Junk DNA, you know, like I think our genome has a history of our evolution. You know, a lot of people don't know that our epidermis, the top layer of skin, knows how to make snake scales, chicken feathers, and fur. If it were put on a dermis, on top of a dermis from a snake or a chicken or a mouse, that there's a whole lot of memory in our DNA of where we come from. It's really one of the most amazing things, I think.
Okay.
It's not necessarily junk. It's not, we're not using it at the moment.
Okay. Next question.
Thank you, Marilyn, for a brilliant exposition. One thought that came to me, and it is about thought. You say everything we think creates from that. And
creates what?
We create everything from thought.
Yeah.
So my questioning is, does each smallest particle have some sort of thought or consciousness, in your opinion?
What's the smallest particle?
Whatever that smallest particle is.
Electron?
If you like, whatever it is.
Well, it has a role, but I don't know if it's conscious as a role, an electron.
As in the terms of, let's say, a magnet. I'm not saying it's got consciousness as such, but it has a facility to have a reaction. Let's put it that way.
I don't know. Maybe somebody else can answer that. I don't know how to answer that. But
that opens up a rather wide question. So let's maybe pursue that in the discussion session tomorrow.
Over a glass of wine.
Or over a glass of wine.
In brief, smiling makes you cheerful, even if you don't know you're doing it. Posture and gait have a huge effect on mood. People hospitalised with depression, made to walk like a cheerful person with a spring in their step, medication halved, very dramatic effect. Music can make you move when you can't otherwise. People can dance when they can't stand or walk. There's a huge, huge area to be explored there.
Yes.
Using the body to affect the mind.
Yeah, terrific. Absolutely. But, you know, what I want is molecular correlations because, as I said, the whole person evidence is subject to reverse causality and confounding influences. If I can actually show deprogramming and reprogramming of genes from a shift from ill health and ill being to well being and flourishing, if I could do that at molecular level, it's indisputable that it's hard to interpret the whole person data scientifically as a look at to find the mechanisms.
Yep. Another question here.
You explained that nurturing in the early years leaves its mark in the epigenetic information. Is there any... Is there a pattern of how many years as the years go on, does the effect of nurturing vary very much? I ask this question because there's a trend with economic forces to for children not to be cared for by their mothers to the age that they used to be. At one time, they used to be cared for by their mothers up to the preschool age, but now often it's very much earlier.
I don't know the answer to that. The work on the large cohorts correlating early experiences with later health and disease is not my work. My work is a sort of molecular identification of mechanisms and discovering deprogramming and reprogramming and development and cancer and stuff like that. This sort of cohort work, the work with at whole individual levels, I'm just reporting other people's work. So I wouldn't be qualified to know the answer to that, really. But somebody in the audience might.
Well, maybe they could say later. I think now we're going to come probably to the last question.
Well, I'd like to get back to the molecular correlation. Do you have any concrete ideas on how to test this empirically? How to conduct a study showing, for example, a relation between practicing Alexander technique and changing one's molecular structures?
I don't. The only thought I had would be in the large cohort studies where blood is collected every few years, over 50 years, was to identify from the quality of life measures made at intervals, to identify those people who turned their life around and do a whole methylome study at intervals with the blood samples, intervals and before and after the turnaround, and to look at the actual changes of epigenetic programming at the gene level. That's the only thing I can think of. You could possibly take a bunch of new Alexander students at the beginning of their training, because it's very intensive training, it's every day for 3 years. So you could take a bunch of students, take their bloods at intervals throughout their training, because you do expect them to change and follow them. I mean, I don't have a lab anymore, so it's a question of finding somebody with a lab who, you know, when writing a proposal and seeing if they want to do that. As I said, that modern medicine and science doesn't give too much attention to changes for the better. It really puts all its efforts into looking at what's wrong with people.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry, but David is looking at me, will be looking at me ferociously if I don't stop now. So I will have to finish the questions, but I'm sure there will be a chance to have further discussion with Marilyn in the session.
Just one comment,
tomorrow.
Tiny comment, just.
Marilyn.
I just want to tell you it was wonderful, and thank you very, very much. It was really wonderful.
Thank you. I know, we're going to say that, yeah. Tuvia has taken the words out of my mouth. I was going to say there were many pearls in your talk, Marilyn. I was particularly like the reference to the inner dogma and the outer dogma, which parallels very much what happens in science.
You can't have more than one dogma, though, can you, really?
I think you can, yeah. You can have inner and outer dogmas, but no more.
No, I think in this sense, you can really only have one dog. I mean, I'm trying to think how to represent.
Well, let's not go into it now. But I just wanted to say there's a beautiful parallel between what happens in physics, the inner science and the outer science, which is what, in a way, the SMN is interested in. But anyway, there are many thoughts we can explore tomorrow, and maybe even have some more experiential sessions. So I just would like you to show your appreciation. We've had to wait 13 years for this talk.
Can I say one thing?
Very quickly.
Just one thing, very quickly. To prove how your thought goes into your body, and for fun, in tonight's...
microphone.
Oh, yes. To prove how your thought every thought you have goes into your body, and to have some fun for our evening's entertainment, ask your partner to put up an arm like that, and tell them to resist pushing it down. Mm. All right? Easy. Now, I want you to think you're a sort of steel girder into the ceiling, and your arm is steel girder into the wall. And now resist me. Oh, you're not.
Sorry, you're irresistible. Sorry, let me do it again. Yeah.
So it was easy.
Now that you still go to here, still go to there. And I can't.
Yeah.
Now, you can do that. Just ask your partner over a glass of wine. Put their arm out and push it down. Then ask them to cement themselves upright and out and push it out. Now, that's just a thought. It's a thought about a cement pole here and a cement pole there. And suddenly the strength in the body is huge. And it's just a thought.
Mm.
Or you could tell them to resist a push. Or tell them, this is the evening entertainment, or tell them to resist a push here.
Yep.
And now think about the top of your head.
Yep.
Think about your feet.
Yep.
All right, think about your centre.
Yep.
Look, I can't.
Yep.
So if you don't know that a thought's extremely powerful, it's instantly changing everything, your strength, that play that with each other. Put down your glass of wine first.
Yeah.
Okay.
However, I'm now have the thought of what David is going to do to me if I don't finish the session. So can we please show our appreciation to Marilyn? Wonderful talk. And I'll just remind you, of course, that now we're going to proceed with the entertainment, which Di is going to